Media. Hey, Danny Schechter.
Known as the News Dissector.
You know, I joined media. Preserving democracy. Do something about the problems of the world. I'm the author. I'm the producer.
Hey, hello, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector.
Issues. The history of the world.
Hey, hello, I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector.
That's me, that's what I think. Demands for justice, losing their hope. Working class solidarity, co-opted battle that hasn't stopped. Issues. CNN, ABC News, WBCN, Boston. That's me, that's what I think. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, what do you think?
And what do you think? Because you're going to have a chance to express it. I'm Danny Schechter here on News Dissector Radio with Polar Levine on PRN-FM, our call in number 888-874-4888. Today is a day for the premiere of the Mandela movie. Long Walk to Freedom is premiering at Lincoln Center for a big celebrity do, which I hope to attend. But on Monday, there's a special screening of the same movie, which doesn't open until the end of the month. Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, and you're going to have a chance to go to that premiere if you so desire, and you'll be able to hear more about how you can find out more about it. Joining me in this first half hour is a woman who has worked tirelessly to support South Africa, to support the post-struggle against apartheid, to help the country develop and to mobilize Americans towards that end with an organization called Shared Interest. And you're going to meet her in a minute. Her name is Donna Katzen. Very bright, very smart, very committed, and very worthwhile listening to. But first, our national anthem. And this song is a song that is very well known. It's considered by many the most beautiful national anthem in the world. Other countries in southern Africa have adopted it as well. Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, Lord, help Africa. And with us on the phone from her offices here in New York, Donna Katzen. Hi, Donna. How are you?
Hi, Danny. Great to be with you and your listeners. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So, you know, we're at the Mandela movie after 16 years in production, development, and the like is finally opening with Idris Elba playing Nelson Mandela, Naomi Harris playing Winnie Mandela, directed by Judson Chadwick, who's an excellent director, produced by Anand Singh. This has been a production in South Africa that I was privileged to be able to witness, the most expensive, biggest movie ever made in South Africa about the leader of South Africa, best known in the world at large, Nelson Mandela. And your organization, Shared Interest, is having a special benefit with this movie on Monday at the 68th Street AMC Theater. You can tell us about it in a minute. But first, why South Africa, Donna? Why are you so obsessed with South Africa? And why am I so obsessed with South Africa?
South Africa is one of those countries, Danny, I think that once it gets under your skin, it doesn't quite ever leave. And particularly those of us who were part of the anti-apartheid movement, along with millions of people around the globe, have had that experience of a people's victory in our time, which is so seldom. Not many moments in history are as exhilarating as when South Africa abolished apartheid and elected Nelson Mandela president after so many years of white domination in the country. However, the reason for just speaking personally and also for our organization's shared interest, which is a nonprofit, the reason we are still firmly committed to South Africa is that the struggle that people worked and fought and died for so many years is not over. As a South African street vendor, Lawrence Mavundla, put it when Mandela was elected, he said, political freedom without economic freedom is not freedom. And recognizing that fact, shared interest began just after Mandela was elected in 1994 to try to help people make an everyday reality out of their hard-won rights. That is, all the people in the country and not just the tiny, well-off few. South Africa still today confronts a poverty rate of nearly 50%, an unemployment rate that's officially 25%, unofficially perhaps double that, and the work continues. So
I think it's,
we are firmly committed to continuing that work to make South Africa the success it needs to be.
Obviously, I think what you're doing is so important, and I really respect your colleagues and yourself and persevering. But, you know, in our media-saturated society, an issue is hot for a while, and then it's dropped by most of the media. You know, South Africa's struggle for freedom and liberation was a story, and then with Mandela's election, it sort of became a non-story, as if the whole problem had been solved. And Americans tend to get turned on by the media and then tuned out by the media as well. As media coverage fell off, interest in South Africa began to fall off. And I think the challenge is, how do you convince people that, you know, political change is not like taking an Alka-Seltzer tablet. You know, you put it in, it fizzes, boom, 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 and you feel better right away. It's not like that. It takes a lot of work, a lot of investment, a lot of time, and it takes mistakes. Making mistakes also, trying to make a difference.
That's absolutely true. And I think one of the challenges that we face in keeping South Africa and the broader movement, in fact, for Southern Africa and perhaps Africa as a whole, in people's mind front and center, one of the things that helps is for us to recognize not only the victories but also the ongoing struggles of everyday people, struggles we can identify with, difficulty being able to start a small business, being able difficulty having a home, a decent home that you can afford to live in, or providing opportunities for your kids and your community. Those are the kinds of struggles that we know in our country. And in South Africa, in fact, some very exciting steps forward are beginning to set precedents, not only in that country, but also precedents that we may be able to learn from around the world.
You know, we'll talk about that some more in a second. Just I want to just tell folks listening, you know, I've just written a book which is coming out in, a week or two, called Madiba A to Z, the Many Faces of Nelson Mandela, because he's a complex figure. He's not a one-dimensional man by any means. And I was privileged to be in South Africa to document the making and the meaning of the movie Long Walk to Freedom, and also to interview a number of leading South Africans who were his comrades, who worked with him, fought alongside him, some fought against him, to talk about the challenges of actually transforming a country. Winning political freedom or winning political rights is tough, it's difficult, it's a challenge. But winning economic, being empowered economically, having control of your resources, being able to make decisions that benefit the majority of the people is not easy. It's certainly not easy in our country, and it's not easy in South Africa. And in my book, I explored that transition where the focus was on winning political rights, ending apartheid, but not necessarily controlling the economy, which was much more difficult. And this is something I go into in Madiba A to Z. Madiba, by the way, is Nelson Mandela's clan name. So that's how he's referred to by most South Africans. Others just call him the old man. Some people call him Tata, which is like old man, you know, what have you. But he's revered and loved by people throughout the country, white and black alike. And what's remarkable is that he's just turned 95 when most of the media was ready to bury him. And he managed to survive, just as he managed to survive, you know, 28 years behind bars. And I think part of the reason the world admires and respects him so much is because of the sacrifices he's associated with, because of the values that he supported a non-racial, non-sexist South Africa and fought for. Didn't achieve everything he fought for, but certainly moved the hands of the clock forward. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think one of the most important points for a U.S. audience, not only are we channel flippers in this country, but we're also somewhat enamored of the cult of the individual, the person, more than the movement. And it's important to remember that this is a story not only about a freedom fighter, but about a freedom fight. And that is so key. We see those freedom fighters in the work that we do daily in South Africa. Women farmers, women who have been excluded not only by colonial rule, not only by apartheid, but also by patriarchy, traditional patriarchy, and also by agribusiness, and still find it very, very difficult to do business as farmers. That tends to be a man's
job. So what does shared interest do to help empower and support people achieving some sort of economic improvements in their lives? I know that's one of your priorities. How do you carry it out? What are your programs?
Well, basically, we have two tools that we use openly. One is a guarantee fund. This is money we borrow from individuals and institutions here, primarily in the States. And we use that money to provide guarantees for South African bank loans to black South Africans, for homes, for businesses, to create jobs, and for farms. So these are folks who would not be getting loans otherwise, not only because they're black, not only because they're women, but when they get to the bank will say, aha, but you have no collateral. And they, because of working with us through our partner, Tembani, in South Africa, are able to say, yes, we do have collateral that is put up by our colleagues, our friends in the United States, who are, in essence, co-signing for the loans. We are taking the risk should they have trouble repaying.
So how many loans are we talking about?
And we've had a hugely positive response.
How many loans are we talking about? How many people have you helped in the years that you've been doing this?
We benefited since 1994 because we started right after Madiba was elected, when South Africa got to be a country you'd want to invest in. We have helped 2.2 million people to date.
Wow.
Which is, and the people want to know, so what are your results? Our loss, we have had about 3% of the loans that we've backed, 3% of the money out, not be repaid. But no investor, none of ours, have ever lost a dime because we provide reserves and because Tembani is such a good risk manager and risk mitigator. But I just want to say that in addition to helping people get access to credit and technical support so that their businesses succeed, so that their farms are productive and so forth, there is an almost invisible kind of technical support that's key to the systems change piece of what we do. And that is providing assistance to help move South Africa's mainstream banks to lend to the majority of people in the country. And this is where we're not only talking about individual benefits, but we're talking about structural change. And our understanding, and we have seen it work in a number of instances, is that if we can get banks to lend to low-income black South Africans, the majority of people in the country, as part of their everyday, ongoing, ordinary business, that is the biggest impact that we can have, because when they wake up and say, what do we need you for? These guys are our ordinary business. We say, exactly. And that means that they will now be providing the services that they will be providing credit where credit is due.
You know, when I made the film In Debt We Trust, 2006, about our own economic crisis in this country, predicting the financial crisis, one of the things that, you know, I learned was that poor people were very good risks for loans. They actually were very responsible and took a lot of pride in paying back those loans, which is really contrary to the stereotype that you have, you know, of people who are irresponsible. And so, in a way, what we're seeing is that by investing in people, investing through structures that have been proven, basically, you can actually have an impact. Now, of course, you're up against a tremendous a number of forces that are moving in the other direction, linked to the market, linked to the, you know, interests of the big players, the mining companies and the banks and the like, who not only dominate in the economic sphere, but they dominate the way people think. They think, they get people to believe that there's no more we to think about. It's only I. Everybody has to get ahead on their own.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, one thing that's interesting in South Africa, and especially as we head into 2014, the 20th anniversary of democracy in the country, also the 20th anniversary of shared interest, which we're going to be celebrating soon, is that the government is still pressing with a lot of popular pressure and demand to deliver. And it is pressing companies to deliver as well. So what that means is that more than in most countries, the corporate sector is being demanded of, being asked to employ as many black people as possible, being asked to purchase from black suppliers, which is small farmers, small businesses, and so forth. And so we are hopeful that, and we are seeing that links to markets are in some ways part of the mainstream effort. I'm not saying that this is happening on a huge scale, but there are significant pressures, and companies do have to report what's their percentage of black owners, how many black suppliers do they use, what is their workforce and their leadership like. So just as we have affirmative action in the U.S., South Africa's Black Economic Empowerment Codes, now they are the broad-based Black Economic Empowerment Codes, are a force that we can work with. And they are able, with other kinds of interventions like ours and many other organizations, they are able to provide opportunities if we, as we used to say in the anti-apartheid movement, keep the pressure on.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that this is very important for people to know about, because when we think about these issues, we tend to reduce it to us and them. We talk about inequality as if there's no way to do anything about it. You know, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. Let's move on to the next topic, okay? And what you are saying, and I think Occupy was saying here as well, is that there are things that can be done. There are ways to make some of these financial institutions more accountable. There are ways to mobilize people to understand that they have an interest in working together and finding resources that will help them improve their lives. I mean, the story in South Africa, having just been there for a year off and on, I found very bleak. You know, certainly in many of the hardcore poverty areas, there's been very little visible change, although a trickle of people are going to school, are going to universities, are becoming professionals and the like. So it's not as if nothing is happening, but part of this is because of what's happening in the world at large and what the United States does and doesn't do, to actually encourage programs like yours. Do you get government support?
No, we've not ever been able to get government support.
So, I mean, there you go. It's the people who are in the best position to help, because they have a track record of years of working with grassroots organizations in the country, with entrepreneurs, with farmers, with students, are often overlooked by our own government aid program, which in a sense aids itself more than it aids the people there. And I'm not talking about AIDS, of course, but I'm talking about economic development.
Well, let me just say one thing. I misspoke there, because that was a generalization. I was thinking you were talking about grants. But in fact, we do get support from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which has provided a $3 million subordinated loan, which means that they are helping to protect our investors' money should there be any losses.
Does the private sector... Go on, I'm sorry.
They are providing that support, and we're quite gratified by that, because OPIC is one of the institutions that has been sympathetic. But yes, we don't get grant money, but we do get this subordinated facility from
Polar Levine here.
Yeah,
in the studio.
Does the private sector in South Africa feel a connection to the nation of South Africa? Because, you know, as you well know, the American private sector has sort of gotten unmoored, you know, in their little hearts, you know, from the American economy, from the American society as a whole.
I'd say it's a mixed bag, really. There are some very committed business people. There are some folks who are dyed-in-the-wool South Africans who have made their money in business, but are progressive. There are progressive people in the business community. There are also pragmatists in the business community that say, this is the country now, and if we want to do well and we want the country to do well, here's what we need to invest.
Because really, that's where the hope seems to be. If they feel some sort of connection with the society,
responsibility, and like.
yeah, they care, but they give a shit, you know. Basically, I think is the important factor here in any sort of societal change.
You know, just one thing that's interesting: South Africa has done way more than most countries with codes of conduct, which have paved the way for expectations for business. And one of the strange things, so many of the tactics that were employed in the anti-apartheid movement have had an ongoing effect that was never anticipated. So when the Sullivan principles came up and companies said, we will do these good things, which would be our contribution to ending apartheid. And then there were all kinds of debates about whether those things made any difference or not, or whether they were window dressing. But nonetheless, what that helped to do, and then there were plenty of codes after the Sullivan principles, so much so that in 1994, when the ANC came into power, the ANC had codes of conduct for companies. South African Council of Churches had codes. KUSATU, the main labor federation, had codes of conduct. And so the culture of codes and expectations for the business community is pretty established, so much so that there's even a socially responsible index on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, which I would love to see in this country.
Oh, wait. Let's leave South Africa for a moment, Donna, because we're running out of time. I want to talk a little bit about how the producers of Long Walk to Freedom, the movie with Idris Elba, Naomi Harris, is distributed by Harvey Weinstein, you know, a big deal movie that's opening in New York at the end of the month, gave Shared Interest a special premiere preview to be able to show this. And you are holding this event on Monday night. Are there still tickets available?
We are just about sold out. So if anybody wants to go, they should go online immediately, www.sharedinterest.org. The site is going to be shut down tomorrow. And the other thing is that if anyone wants to go, they should simply show up on Monday the 18th at AMC Lowe's Lincoln Square 13, 1998 Broadway at 68th Street. There's no guarantee that there will be tickets left. We are just about sold out now.
Well, that's good news, isn't it? I mean, that's an achievement. That's a great achievement. I'm going to be there also with the copies of my book on sale and also a chance to meet people. So it's going to be quite an event. It's also a way in which the producers of the movie are giving back to the people in America who have stood up and stood by South Africa over all of these years in order to keep the struggle going and to try to keep it moving forward. And, you know, there's a lot of cynics out there. There's a lot of people who are disillusioned, burned out, and all the rest of it. But there's also a core of people in the country who are so amazing, so committed, and are trying so hard to improve their lives. And I think that's the example that we see when we actually meet with ordinary South African people and you know, it's contagious in a way. I think that's why I became involved the way I did, and I think that's why you remain involved the way you do, Donna.
Yeah.
True?
Yeah. And because we know that this struggle, like the movie, is itself a long walk to freedom, anybody who'd like to be involved in this work on an ongoing basis should feel free to contact us. We will be here after Monday as well at www.sharedinterest.org. We'd love to hear from people. And we hope that you will join us in renewing our commitment to making South Africa the country for which so many people have worked so hard.
And fought and died for. And this is a story that really should be page one in the New York Times, but you've heard it here, and we're pleased to bring it to you because it's one of the really important organizations that's making a difference and also creating an example of solidarity for other countries. We're right now dealing with this terrible crisis in the Philippines, demands for relief and help. But once, you know, that gets out of the headlines, the contributions will undoubtedly fall off, leaving the people there with a lot to try to deal with, to put their lives back in order. So I think Shared Interest is a model beyond just being an organization, and you deserve a lot of credit, Donna, for the work you've done. So I
and
wanted to
you,
have
Danny.
You on. I really mean that sincerely. And you know, this is something that is really important to, for those of us who care about the world and care about trying to intervene in some positive way in helping to make change in the world. So sharedinterest.org is out there. You can help if you want. And also to see this movie, Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom. In our next segment, we're actually going to speak with one of the leading experts in America on the Iran negotiations with the United States on the nuclear issue. He's going to tell us, hopefully, a lot of things that the news isn't reporting. So thank you, Donna, for being
thank
here
so much,
on Newsnight Sector Radio. Some of the beautiful power of Iranian music. We've had a terrible tragedy in New York with several Iranian musicians being killed by one of their own here in, I think, Brooklyn, or was it Queens?
It was at Williamsburg.
In Williamsburg, you know, a horror show of some people came to make it here, and I don't know what happened, but it was really a tragedy instead of a success story. Right now, the United States has been involved with other powers in negotiations with Iran dealing with the nuclear issue. And William Beeman, a professor of anthropology at the University of Minnesota, now on leave at Stanford University, is somebody who I turn to regularly in print and met once or twice for information about Iran that doesn't come filtered through a news system that tends to kind of reinforce the official hostility or the hostility in some quarters to Iran, particularly among neocons and right-wingers who don't want any real, you know, any agreement with Iran, want to bash Iran, want to go to a war with Iran. So, Professor Beeman, welcome. Thank you for agreeing to come on board. I wonder if you can give us a little rundown of where things stand in these negotiations.
The United States and the P plus five nations, including the United States, have been meeting with Iran in Vienna. They've had now three meetings, and thus far the negotiations have been inconclusive. They've both sides seem to be optimistic about reaching some kind of agreement, but thus far it hasn't happened. And they're going to be meeting again on November 20th. And so there's hopes that that they'll be able to reach an accord at that time. These are difficult negotiations because the P5 plus one nations, that is the United States and its European allies, are trying to do something which is very difficult, and that is they're trying to get Iran to abrogate its treaty rights under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They're making demands on Iran that is... they're making demands on Iran that would require Iran to voluntarily relinquish its treaty rights. And there are now, you know, 189 nations, actually, that have signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And no other nation is being asked to do things like, for instance, suspend uranium enrichment or to agree to extraordinary inspections that are not included under the treaty. So quite naturally, Iran is not willing to do this unless they get something quite substantial in return, because they really are giving up rights that they have by treaty, and a treaty that the United States has signed. One of the other aspects of this is that that Israel is standing on the sidelines, trying very hard to sabotage these talks. And Israel has no standing in these discussions because Israel is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and Israel has about 250, by everybody's estimate, nuclear warheads ready to launch. And so it is they're an interloper in these matters. But they are an important interloper because they have such strong support, especially in the United States, with various pro-Israel groups, such as the American Israel Public Affairs
Committee.
So this
is the lobby. The lobby of Israel is certainly attempting, if not to kill the negotiations, to make them impossible to achieve anything because the conditions that are imposed, are basically undoable by the Iranian side. France objected seemingly at the last minute to the negotiations that were taking place, and some people think it was Israel really orchestrating the French reaction. What's your view of that?
I thoroughly agree with that. My colleague Gareth Porter has just published a very thorough article on the website Truthout that details in great details to a great extent exactly what happened with regard to France's last-minute objection to the agreements that had been reached. And the United States was put in a terrible diplomatic bind here because the U.S. was not able to not able to really blame France for this for diplomatic reasons. And so the United States turned to the knee-jerk solution of blaming Iran for the breakdown of the talks.
Yeah, and I would think that the U.S. Congress would have provided enough obstruction that we wouldn't even need France as an excuse.
Well, the U.S. Congress is not at the negotiating table. And that's they may be putting pressure on the Obama administration.
Well, that's what I mean.
To try to scuttle these talks, but they're not there at the negotiating table, and the United States is not the only partner in the negotiations. The other five nations that are doing the negotiating are also part of it. So, plus of course Iran. So what the Congress is doing is indirectly trying to put pressure on the U.S. government to abandon these negotiations. I wouldn't say everybody in Congress. You know, there are many Congress people like my own Representative Keith Ellison or Ron Wyden in Oregon and a number of others who are much more sensible about this. But certainly the House of Representatives and the hawks in the House of Representatives and a few in the Senate, like Lindsey Graham, are absolutely convinced that we need to have some violent action against Iran for reasons that are unclear to me.
It seems as if Fox News is the voice of that viewpoint, often in a very strident and hysterical way. And so the story gets filtered to the American people in a very one-sided way. You know, it doesn't really, the context is often lost in the news reporting.
Well, what is really important for the American public to understand is that all of these talks are taking place within the framework of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, what you hear on Fox News and in other places are all sorts of extraneous things, like we can't let Iran, we have to shut down the nuclear program in Iran because they support Hezbollah, or because they don't give full rights to women. Both of these, by the way, are false statements, but whether they're false or true, they have absolutely nothing to do with these negotiations.
Why Professor, why let the facts get in the way of a good argument?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? I mean, these people, if they don't regurgitate, you know, message points that they're handed in the morning by the lobbies, invent all sorts of, and play to all sorts of fears and whatnot. And it's interesting that the, I think it was the Prime Minister of Iran used Twitter to challenge John Kerry, the Secretary of State, for changing his own position.
Actually, it was the Minister of Foreign Affairs,
Javad Zarif.
Dr. Zarif is a graduate of the University of California in San Diego in international relations. He is an extremely, with a PhD from that institution, he's an extremely erudite individual. He was the UN representative for Iran under the last administration. And he and Dr. Rouhani, who is the prime minister, both are, they're both extremely experienced, very erudite, well-published PhD individuals with who speak multiple languages and are highly sophisticated. They outrank, quite honestly, in terms of their experience and intelligence, a good number of the American negotiating team.
The Iranian side claimed that that Kerry or the United States canceled, you know, half of the proposal that was being made. Do you know what that was about?
You know, they accused them also of spinning.
Actually, the little Twitter message, the 140-character Twitter message from Dr. Zarif, didn't actually accuse the United States of canceling the half of the treaty. He said, "Who did it?" He framed it as a question. Actually, he may not even know, because what took place in the negotiations with the P5+1 nations who brought to the table was a kind of a black box. And what happened was that the treaty conditions were modified overnight. And when the Iranians on Sunday saw the treaty conditions, they were different than what they were on Saturday, and the negotiations then broke down. And so something happened over between Saturday night and Sunday to modify these materials. Secretary Kerry said is technically correct. That is that the P5+1 nations were unified in what they wanted to say, but they were only unified after these modifications had been made.
Did he deny that those changes were made?
No, he didn't deny anything. He was technically correct. On Sunday morning, the P5+1 nations had a unified position, but it was not the same position that they had on Saturday.
So this is almost like a theater of the absurd there, isn't it? I mean, it ranges. It doesn't focus on whatever is being discussed. And yet they all claim that they want an agreement. Can they achieve an agreement with this type of, you know, drama going on, with this type of, you know, conniving going on?
Well, both sides want things that are very hard for the other side to agree to. The United States not only has sanctions being applied to Iran, but also the U.S. Congress is pushing hard for even more stringent sanctions. So the United States is—it's a classic standoff. The United States is saying, "Okay, you give up part of your treaty rights, and then we'll relinquish the sanctions." And Iran says, "You give us something first, and then we'll think about, you know, voluntarily abrogating our treaty rights." And so one side or the other has to give way. There has to be some concession. For the Obama administration, if they make the slightest concession to Iran first, if they take the first step, they're going to get savaged in the political arena by the Republicans. The Republicans are already going crazy over the Affordable Care Act. And you can imagine on top of that what would happen if they make the first move toward concessions toward Iran.
And here we have Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, hardly a progressive, saying that this is in America's interest to do this deal. Why is that?
There's no question about that.
Explain that to us.
All.
Why is it in our interest to do a deal with Iran? What's in it for us, so to speak?
Well, Iran has a population of 72 million people. It stands in an absolutely strategic location in the Middle East between the Caspian Sea and the Persian Gulf. They have the largest coastline on the Persian Gulf. They are a major oil producer. They're a major gas producer. The United States and Iran have common cause in the stability in the region. Iran was opposed to the Taliban. It actually tried to help us when we were fighting the Taliban during the Bush administration. And then President Bush came out with the Axis of Evil speech in his State of the Union address and completely turned them off. Iran is ready to cooperate with us in environmental issues, in drug interdiction, and, of course, in trade. And the breakthrough to Iran would be a major, major economic boon to the United States, to the region, and a major boon to peace in the world.
Well, what about countries like Russia and China? You know, they've been asked by the United States to respect our sanctions, blah, blah, blah. What's going to happen there, you know, if people begin to sour on this whole process, if it gets actually, you know, not only stymied but stalemated as a result of, you know, kind of Israeli orchestrated attacks on the whole process?
China and Russia both know that the nuclear question with Iran is a false issue. It is a phony issue. And that the right wing in the United States and Israel has been ginning up this issue since 2003, since the invasion of Iraq, as a way of actually scoring political points internally within their country. If you take a look at the political commentary that's coming out of China, the serious Chinese analysts, political scientists and nuclear scientists, the same in Russia, have said again and again and again that the idea that Iran is a nuclear danger or even making nuclear weapons is phony. And so the Chinese and the Russians are in total agreement with this. And I should also say that the non-aligned nations of the world, 218 of them, have many, many times voted to support Iran's right to enrich uranium. Iran itself has renounced nuclear weapons, and there is no evidence anywhere by any intelligence agency or any military authority, including the International Atomic Energy Agency, that Iran actually has a nuclear program or has diverted any nuclear material toward the making of weapons.
Well,
there is no evidence. And so it is a phony issue.
What's the motive for promoting, you know, this whole thing about having them not develop the bomb?
Well, they're not developing the bomb. That's the thing.
Well, I mean, what motivates the this whole drama about it?
It started in 2003 under the Bush administration when this anti-Iranian group, the Mujahideen Khalq, or the MEK, came to the Bush administration and said, oh, Iran is building a bomb. And the Bush administration, stupidly, because they didn't have any kind of bead on their own intelligence, went just apoplectic about this.
These are the same people that said Iraq had WMDs, right?
That's right. They said Iraq had WMDs. And we should also remember that a group of neoconservatives had already laid out a plan in the mid-1990s for Prime Minister Netanyahu for a complete restructuring of the Middle East, a complete set of regime changes in the Middle East. And this is all documented. It's all on paper. Their first order of business was to get rid of Saddam Hussein, which has happened. The second was to get rid of Syria, which is underway right now. And the third was to have regime change in Iran. And that was a method that they thought was going to cement security for Israel. And so this plan has been carried out pretty much as they had anticipated. And the nuclear weapons charge against Iran was the one thing that they knew that the American public would buy. They could use all kinds of other sorts of excuses. Iran has a bad human rights record. It's certainly true, but the American public doesn't care. What the American public does care about is nuclear bombs.
I still love that drawing that Mr. Netanyahu brought to the United Nations, where he, on basis of Israeli intelligence, they drew a picture of what the bomb would look like. It looked like something out of a kindergarten, you know.
Right out of Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner, you know, a big round bomb with a fuse. That's actually been their tactic, And the U.S. public has really bought this line, hook, line, and sinker, despite the fact that there is no evidence that Iran is actually building a bomb.
Could that be because there is no press in the United States? In other words, media has not really been independent and critical on these issues.
The worst thing has been that the New York Times has taken the lead with this. The worst journalist on Iran is David Sanger, and who has repeatedly lied. He has misled people. He has repeated things in the press that absolutely did not happen. He rewrites reports that come from the International Atomic Energy Agency. He is absolutely the worst on Iran in terms of misleading the public, and because it's the New York Times.
Also misleading elites.
What is written.
Also, misleading political elites that read the New York Times,
That's correct.
The New York Times.
He'll write something in the morning and he'll contradict himself in the same piece. He'll write something at the beginning of his piece and then in the end say, that wasn't really true.
It's interesting. There's a defection seemingly underway now with top reporters leaving the New York Times. The New York Times almost every day for 10 days featured front page stories about de Blasio here in New York and why he was a menace and a threat. And at the end of those 10 days, his ratings went up with the public. Okay.
Right.
And the New York Times later endorsed him for mayor. After trashing him, for months. So, this is also the New York Times influence seems to be mostly with certain political elites that want message points or evidence to fulfill what they already believe.
By the way, it's not, I don't want to tar everybody with the same brush. Roger Cohen, writing in the New York Times, is British, has consistently been much more moderate on Iran and actually quite sensible. And I should also mention that their correspondent in Tehran, Thomas Erdebrink, has also given very accurate, very good reports on Iran. But David Sanger and Michael Gordon, to name two of them, have been terrible, and they essentially have been spewing propaganda instead of actually reporting.
Well, this speaks,
and they've turned the tide for a lot of the public in the United States.
This speaks, William Beeman, to my focus on media issues as being really central to how people understand the world. I'm editing mediachannel.org. I blog every day at newsdissector.net, trying to offer another way of looking at these stories, relying on sources, more diverse sources, to try to explain what's really going on, including some of your own work and the article that you cited today about the negotiations and what have you. But it seems like it's an uphill battle when you're up against the distracted American public and a kind of wild gang of anti-Obamacrats, who basically...
Well, it's not just that, but the media is being propagandized by a number of think tanks in Washington. The worst one, in my view, is the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, WINEP. They've had PBS and the PBS NewsHour continually features people coming from WINEP who are misleading the public again. They're telling absolute fabrications about the Iranian situation. And they have a multi-million dollar publicity campaign. They brag about how much press they get. They have a stable of people in their organization that does nothing but writes op-eds and then somebody else to flack them to editors who are lazy. And don't really bother to actually look up the facts. And once you have truth by repetition in this way, then individuals like me, we just don't have a chance. And I'm an academic. I have a job. I can't sit around 24/7 trying to propagandize against Iran like these organizations do.
Do you have a website?
I do. It's my blog is at www.wbeeman.com. And I have an academic website, which is www.williambeeman.com.
And Beeman is B-E-E-M-A-N, correct?
B-E-E-M-A-N, that's right.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. You have something else to do right now. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today and offer some information and analysis that is unfortunately sorely missing in much of our media. William Beeman, the University
Thank
of
you.
Min-
if you
Minnesota.
Take a minute, I'll also suggest a book that I wrote in 2008, and I'm in the process of revising it and updating it. It's called The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other, and it's very inexpensive from the University of Chicago Press.
Well, that's the book to read, and this is the person to listen to. We're glad you've joined us here, because this issue, of course, is very much on some people's minds, certainly in the media, which is in desperate need of a correction. So we thank you again for coming on here. I'm going to be citing some of these articles in my blog at newsdissector.net tomorrow, as well as the podcast of this conversation will be available as well, and I'm going to send that to you, Bill, if you want to put it up on your website. So thank you so much again for coming on News Dissector Radio.
Thank you very much. I appreciate what you're doing.
We have a little treat for you going out, a new song that we've just heard about. You want to tell us about it, Mr. Levine?
Yeah, this is something that's just been released or about to be released. It's by the reggaeton group Cali 13, and it features Rage Against the Machine's Tom Morello, and also some spoken stuff by Julian Assange, of all people. And we're about to hear that right now. And it's a call out against the corporate controlled media that profits from lying.
You live in the world of your propaganda maze. Where you think you are strong, you are weak. Your lies tell us the truth we will use against you. Your secrecy shows us where we will strike. Your weapons reveal your fear for all to see. From Cairo to Quito, a new world is forming. The power of people armed with the truth.
Todo empieza con una llamarada cuando despedimos llamas de nuestras miradas. Quieren detener el incendio que se propaga, pero hay fuegos que con agua no se apagan. Y se acerca la línea policíaca, los músculos se tensan y aumenta la frecuencia cardíaca. Suben los niveles de testosterona y empieza ese momento en el que se enfrentan las personas. Cuando somos amigos del coraje, cuando gritar se convierte en nuestro único lenguaje. A mí me ordena la razón, a ti te ordena un coronel. Si nuestra lucha es de cartón, la de ustedes es de papel. Y no nos paran, porque un mensaje contundente convierte a cualquier teniente en un tiburón sin dientes. El Estado nos teme, porque al mismo tiempo somos 132 y 15M. Si la prensa no habla,
nosotros damos los detalles,
pintando las paredes,
con aerosol en las calles.
Levanto mi pancarta y la difundo, con solo una persona que la lea, ya empieza a cambiar el mundo.
In Spanish, calle means street, and this is music of the streets, and you heard a little soundbite before from the director of WikiLeaks. So that's a song that we wanted to share with you,
yeah,
and go out with
today. It's called Multiviral, by the way, and you can download it for free up on SoundCloud.
SoundCloud. Calle, is it Calle 17?
Calle 13.
Calle 13 here on News Dissector News Hour. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Pilar, for being here. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. We'll be back next week with more.